This is Audible.
HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History by Bill Shutt. Read by Tom Perkins. Prologue. A census taker tried to quantify me once. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a big amarone. Thomas Harris, The Silence of the Lambs. To mark its 100-year anniversary in 2003, the American Film Institute polled a jury of 1,500 actors, writers, directors, and historians to determine the 50 greatest screen villains of all time. Topping the AFI list was the ultimate in fictionalized cannibals, Dr. Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter. In The Silence of the Lambs, Jonathan Demme's Academy Award-winning vision of the Thomas Harris novel, Lecter, memorably portrayed by Sir Anthony Hopkins, helps recently graduated FBI recruit Clarice Starling track down Buffalo Bill, a serial killer who skins his female victims in order to tailor a woman suit. Second place in the poll went to Norman Bates, the mother-fixated hotel manager inhabiting Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 classic Psycho. Okay, I know what you're thinking. Norman Bates wasn't a cannibal. But just give me a minute. From the opening scene, Hitchcock invited Eisenhower-era audiences to indulge in some long-held taboos. Filmgoers titillated the previous year by the first of the Rock Hudson Doris Day bedroom comedies suddenly found themselves transformed into voyeurs, peering into shadowy corners previously unseen by mainstream movie audiences of the 1950s. From an amorous lunch hour rendezvous, where the half-clad lovers had obviously just risen from their unmade hotel room bed, to a peephole in the Bates Motel, nobody would be confusing Hitchcock's masterpiece with pillow talk. Released to a mixed critical response, the movie became a sensation with audiences, and remains so today. More than a half-century after its release, Bernard Herrmann's strings-only score is perhaps the most instantly recognizable music ever written for a film. Less well known is the fact that Joseph Stefano's screenplay for Psycho had been adapted from a Robert Bloch pulp novel about Wisconsin native Edward Gein, a real-life murderer, grave robber, necrophile, and cannibal. Born in 1906, Gein lived a solitary and repressive life under the thumb of a domineering mother. The family owned a 160-acre farm 7 miles outside the town of Plainfield. But when his brother died in 1944, Gein abandoned all efforts to cultivate the land. Instead, he relied on government aid and the occasional odd job to support himself and his mother. When she died in 1945, Gein found himself alone in the large farmhouse, sealing off much of it and leaving his mother's room exactly as it looked when she was alive. The house itself fell into such serious disrepair that the neighborhood kids began claiming that it was haunted. On the night of November 17, 1957, things began to unravel for the recluse known as Weird Old Eddie. The police were investigating the disappearance of local store owner Bernice Warden when they got a tip that Gein had been seen in her hardware store several times that week. They picked him up at a neighbor's house where he was having dinner and questioned him about the missing woman. "She isn't missing," Gein told them. "She's down at the house now." Gein's dilapidated farmhouse had no electricity, so the cops used flashlights and oil lamps to pick their way through the debris-laden rooms. In a shed out back, one of the men bumped into what he thought were the remains of a dressed-out deer hanging from a wooden beam. But the fresh carcass hanging upside down was no deer. It was the decapitated body of Mrs. Warden. As the stunned lawmen moved through the gruesome crime scene, it became clear that the neighborhood kids had been right. The Gein house was haunted. Each room they entered presented them with a new nightmare: soup bowls made from human skulls, a pair of lips attached to a window shade drawstring, and a belt made from human nipples. In the kitchen, the police reportedly found Bernice Warden's heart sitting in a frying pan on the stove and an icebox stocked with human organs. Soon after Gein's arrest, Media correspondents from all over the world began descending on the town and its shocked populace. The reporters poked around the Gein farm and interviewed neighbors. Some of the locals recounted how they'd been given venison by Gein, who later told authorities that he had never shot a deer in his life. The Plainfield butcher had also been a popular babysitter. With the publication of a 7-page article in Life magazine and a 3-page spread in Time, millions of Americans became fascinated with Ed Gein and his crimes. Plainfield became a tourist attraction with bumper-to-bumper traffic crawling through the narrow streets. Jokes called Geinisms became popular. Question: what did Ed Gein give his girlfriend for Valentine's Day? Answer: a box of Farmer Fannies. The following year, Robert Bloch loosely adapted the Gein crimes for his novel, relocating his tale to Phoenix and concentrating on the mother fixation aspects of the story while playing down the mutilation and cannibalism. An assistant gave Alfred Hitchcock the book, and he procured the film rights soon after reading it. The director also had his staff buy up as many copies of the novel as they could find. He wanted to prevent readers from learning about the plot and then revealing its secrets. After some initial resistance from Paramount Pictures, the master of suspense directed his most famous and financially successful film, one that would never have been made if not for Ed Gein, a quiet little cannibal, who explained to the authorities, "I had a compulsion to do it." Is it really a surprise, though, that our greatest cinematic villain is a man-eating psychiatrist, while the mild-mannered runner-up is based on a real-life cannibal killer? Perhaps not if one considers that many cultures share the belief that consuming another human is the worst, or close to the worst, behavior that a person can undertake. As a result, real-life cannibalistic psychopaths like Jeffrey Dahmer, another Wisconsin native, and his Russian counterpart, Andrei Chikatilo, have attained something akin to mythical status in the annals of history's most notorious murderers. Whether through a filter of fictionalization, where man-eating deviants are transformed into powerful anti-heroes, or through tabloids sensationalizing the crimes of real-life cannibals, these tales feed our obsession with all things gruesome, an obsession that is now an acceptable facet of our society. A different attitude was taken toward primitive social or ethnic groups whose members might not have shared the Western take on cannibalism taboos. At best, these savages were pegged as souls to be saved, but only if they met certain requirements. In the first half of the 20th century, for example, explorers and the missionaries who followed them ventured into the foreboding New Guinea highlands and quickly imposed one hard and fast rule for the locals. Cannibalism in any form was strictly forbidden. But far worse instances of cultural intrusion occurred elsewhere and throughout history, as those accused of consuming other humans for any reason were brutalized, enslaved, and murdered. The most infamous example of this practice began during the last years of the 15th century, when millions of indigenous people living in the Caribbean and Mexico were summarily reclassified as cannibals for reasons that had little to do with people eating. Instead, it paved the way for them to be robbed, beaten, conquered, and slain, all at the whim of their new Spanish masters. Similar atrocities were carried out on a massive scale by a succession of flag-planting European powers who, if one believes their accounts, wrested South America, Africa, and the Indo-Pacific away from man-eating savages, whose behavior placed them beyond the pale of anything that could remotely be described as human. So were European fears about cannibalism simply an invention used to justify conquest? Or were their cultures, including those encountered by the Spaniards, where the consumption of humans was regarded as normal behavior? Although defining someone as a cannibal became an effective way to dehumanize them, there is also evidence that ritual cannibalism, as embodied in various customs related to funerary rites and warfare, occurred throughout history. As I began studying these forms of cannibalism, I sought to determine not only their perceived functions, but just how widespread they were or weren't. Surprisingly, or perhaps not surprisingly given the subject matter, there is disagreement among anthropologists regarding ritual cannibalism. Some deny that it ever occurred, while others claim that the behavior did occur but was uncommon. Still others claim that cannibalism was practiced by many cultures throughout history and for a variety of reasons. One such body of evidence led me straight back to European history, where I learned that a particularly macabre form of cannibalism had been practiced for hundreds of years by nobility, physicians, and commoners alike, even into the 20th century. As a zoologist, I was, of course, intrigued at the prospect of documenting cases of non-human cannibalism. Looking back now, I can see that I'd started my inquiry with something less than a completely open mind. Part of me reasoned that since cannibalism was presumably a rare occurrence in humans, at least in modern times, it would likely be similarly rare in the animal kingdom. Once I dug further, though, I discovered that cannibalism differs in frequency between major animal groups, non-existent in some and common in others. It varies from species to species and even within the same species, depending on local environmental conditions. Cannibalism also serves a variety of functions, depending on the cannibal. There are even examples in which an individual being cannibalized receives a benefit. In several instances, cannibalism appears to have arisen only recently in a species, and human activity might be the cause. In one such case, news reports informed horrified audiences that some of the most highly recognizable animals on the planet were suddenly consuming their own young. "Polar bears resort to cannibalism as Arctic ice shrinks," reported CNN, while the Times of London echoed the sentiment, "Climate change forcing polar bears to become cannibals." It was Reuters, though, that scored a perfect 10 on the gruesome scale, with an online slideshow in which an adult polar bear was seen carrying around the still cute-as-a-button head of a dead cub, the remains of its spinal cord trailing behind like a red streamer. The real story behind polar bear cannibalism turned out to be just as fascinating, though it would also serve as a perfect example of how many accusations of and stories about cannibalism throughout history were untrue, unproven, or exaggerated, distorted by sensationalism, deception, a lack of scientific knowledge, and just plain bad writing. With the passage of time, these accounts too often become part of the historical record, their errors long forgotten. Part of my job would be to expose those errors. I was also extremely curious to see if the origin of cannibalism taboos could be traced back to the natural world, so I developed a pair of alternative hypotheses. Perhaps our aversion to consuming our own kind is hardwired into our brains, and as such is a part of our genetic blueprint, a gene or two whose expression selects against such behavior. I reasoned that if such a built-in deterrent exists, then humans, and most non-humans, with the exception of a few well-known anomalies such as black widow spiders and praying mantises, would avoid cannibalism at all costs. Thus, the taboo would have a biological foundation. Conversely, I weighed the possibility that the revulsion most people have at the very mention of cannibalism might stem solely from our culture. Of course, this led to even more questions. What are the cultural roots of the cannibalism taboo, and how has it become so widespread? I also wondered why, as disgusted as we are at the very thought of cannibalism, we're so utterly fascinated by it. Might cannibalism have been more common in our ancestors, before societal rules turned it into something abhorrent? I looked for evidence in the fossil record and elsewhere. Finally, I considered what it would take to break down the biological or cultural constraints that prevent us from eating each other on a regular basis. Could there come a time in our not-so-distant future when human cannibalism becomes commonplace? And for that matter, was it already becoming a more frequent occurrence? The answers to these questions are far from certain, but, then again, there is much about the topic of cannibalism that cannot be neatly divided into black and white. Likely or not, though, the circumstances that might lead to outbreaks of widespread cannibalism in the 21st century are grounded in science, not science fiction. My aim was to stay away from the cliched ideas about cannibalism that are already ingrained in our collective psyche, and, with such a wealth of relevant material to explore, I quickly realized that this wouldn't be difficult. Even the most famous cannibal stories, it turned out, had factual gaps that are only now being filled. In the case of the Donner Party, for example, I joined researchers whose scientific approach to the most infamous cannibalism-related event in American history had shed new light on this 19th-century tale of stranded pioneers. I've tried to approach each example from a scientific viewpoint, delving into what I considered the most intriguing aspects of anthropology, evolution, and biology, to provide the broadest yet most engaging natural history of this behavior. What happens to our bodies and minds under starvation conditions? Why are women better equipped to survive starvation than men? And what physiological extremes would compel someone to consume the body of a friend or even a family member? With regard to criminal cannibalism, Jeffrey Dahmer and his ilk, I was less interested in the overhashed and gory details of the crimes than the reasons for our enthrallment with the overhashed and gory details. This is not a book that explores the minds of our so-called cannibal killers, though it does seem that instances of cannibalism-related crime may be on the uptick. I've also taken a hard line on sensationalism by highlighting and differentiating between physical evidence, ethnohistory, unfounded information, and horse feathers. In this book, you will encounter everything from cannibalism in utero to placenta-munching mothers who carry on a remarkably rich tradition of medicinal cannibalism. Yes, the ick factor is high, but I hope you will find this journey as fascinating and unusual as I have, a journey whose goal is to allow us to better understand the complexity of our natural world and the long and often blood-spattered history of our species. With this in mind, why not grab a glass of red wine? And let's get started.